Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to the Free Cities Podcast, episode number 13. Unlucky for some, I suppose, but not for you, since we are continuing our series of interviews from Prague. And on today's show, I'm talking with a lady by the name of Pavla Karen. Now, Pavla is what I would describe as an anarcho-capitalist entrepreneur and mother. But labels aside, she's also a super interesting person to talk to, who has much to say on the subjects of freedom and liberty, especially in the context of business, parenthood, and relationships. Our conversation goes in many directions, but in particular we discuss subjects such as what it was like growing up under socialism, bringing up free children, digital nomadism, tools for staying free, and the path to inner freedom, particularly in relationships. On that subject, in her own marriage, Pavla and her husband practice something called ethical non-monogamy, which she sees as a natural extension of her libertarian beliefs. This was a fascinating conversation that was unfortunately constrained by my busy schedule. However, I will certainly be recording a part two in the future. In the meantime, it just leaves for me to say to you, please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Pavla Karen. Let's start right back at the beginning. You're Czech, right?
That's right.
Born and bred.
Yeah, correct.
And have you... Am I allowed to ask how old you are? Only for the context of
absolutely.
Did you or did you not live through any socialism?
Yeah, I'm 38. So I was born in 1984. So I was five when the wall fell and the revolution happened. So I didn't really experience this firsthand. But of course, I experienced the effects of communism, which linger for generations. And I would say I'm still very deeply affected by it because my parents grew up in socialism. They were heavily shaped by it. And as such, I grew up in a very like conservative kind of right-wing thinking family, because that was the opposition to the system that they grew up in. And they saw the horrible damage it inflicted on the economic systems, but even on a deeper level, really on the human psyche, how damaging that was because of the secrecy, because of the deception, not being able to even like, you know, be honest in public and just leading a double life, really. And it's even smaller things than that. For example, my father, who has a huge love of rock and roll, he always said, the one thing I will never forgive the communists for is that I was never allowed to see the Beatles.
Right.
You know, a tiny little thing like that, but that was really taken away from them. And
But let me just ask you, when you said that you grew up in a right-wing-ish family,
mm-hmm.
Was that a secret right-wing family, or did that happen when communism sort of dissipated and people were allowed to...
Well, because everything that was happening, like prior to the revolution in 1989, was people just hated socialists, right? Except for like a small majority of mostly like the grandmas who were a little bit clueless, if I may say so. There was no public support for it anymore in the last like years heading to the revolution. So people were naturally looking for the alternatives, and the alternative was, or the biggest enemy of socialism was always America. So it was idolized. Everything American, everything Western, everything kind of like in the Reagan era, that was idolized because it was in opposition to communism. So it was kind of like what you defaulted to. So everything that was American was seen as better. Any American product was seen as just like the amazing thing that you desire. And in contrast, anything Soviet Russian was bad. So it was almost like the default state of people naturally. My family was and is still like right-wing thinking and very pro-liberty also.
Just,
in that sense.
I One other thing I've noticed in being here is the terminology of left wing, right wing.
Yeah,
over here it's slightly. What does that mean? Because I can't keep up with it even back home.
Yeah,
and I thought I used to know what these terms meant, but now liberalism appears to be something that it didn't used to be. I mean, what are you talking about there? And try and sort of explain it.
Yeah. To me, right wing traditionally is more pro personal liberty and lower taxes, lower regulations, where left wing is the opposite of that. So it's more socialist. Government takes more and tells you more of what to do. I know that those definitions have shifted, and liberalism, traditional liberalism, is almost like the opposite of how it's used today. To be somebody who's liberal today, you would associate with leftist, right? Left wing.
Yes.
Yeah, it used to mean that. So it's good to define those terms. And I do feel like the goalposts are almost shifting. Like when you're somebody who was a traditional conservative maybe 20 years ago, now they would be almost labeled far right. I don't know how that
happened. Well, it depends who's labeling them, of course.
Of course.
But mm-hmm. on the whole, yes. Many people are now classed. I think even libertarians as a bunch are now right wing. And
probably.
I don't know. I mean, I've always thought of myself as just, not even being anything. I mean, being pro-liberty doesn't even have to put you on a wing, I don't think. So you grew up with, libertarian-minded parents. Is that fair
Correct.
To say?
Correct.
They were into rock and roll. They must have been pretty cool.
Oh, they're super cool, and they're fantastic. I mean, our opinions are not the same anymore as much, but we always have like really interesting conversations, and I think that's the one thing that they always encourage is at least dialogue. Like a dinner table, we would talk about politics, we would talk about some difficult topics and disagree often, but it was invited, you know, and I really cherish that, and I try to also instill that in my kids. Like, it's actually okay to disagree, and I think disagreement is so healthy and so important without like angry labeling. So you can start doing that with kids when they're literally 2 years old. You can literally debate with them on their level and about topics they're interested in. It's so crucial to do that. So I'm very blessed that my parents always did that. And, you know, as I grew up, I kind of turned away from the traditional conservatism into more libertarianism. And then anarcho-capitalism, I'm still basically at heart like an anarcho-capitalist. I love Rothbard, reading all his essays, I remember. I still believe everything should be private, nothing should be forced. That's it. Then we'll have a great society.
So an anarcho-capitalist maximus.
Correct. That's my belief, yes.
Everything.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything.
Well, no exceptions. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, I mean, me too. I've never seen it.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what it's like. Because, do you know what? Whenever people say that, I think of the similar thing about the other end of the spectrum, or even say communism, which was, communism hasn't really been tried yet for real. So
I don't like when they say that.
Right, but aren't we saying that about the free market? It's like it's never really been tried. So
it has, though, because actually we do live it to a certain extent, because not everything is regulated. All those areas of life that are not regulated are governed by voluntary principles, right? About some unspoken rules that we all abide by. For example, the fact that you come to a shop and you say hello and you're courteous to other people, and you know, a lot of interpersonal relationships, there's really no rules for those, and it all kind of works. So everything that actually is not regulated is by definition voluntary. So a large part of our human interactions is already like voluntarist. It's anarcho-capitalist in essence. And of course there's all the other stuff which is usually overregulated. And this tends to be those areas of human interaction that do not work so well, or parts of the economy that are a disastrous state, you know, like the healthcare system or education, as we mentioned. So the more you regulate, the worse it is. And the more you leave it, the better it works.
Well, I wouldn't even say the better, but the more correctly it probably works. I mean, it's the way it should be, arguably. The very unfair thing about top-down decision making is it's not your decision. And
yes, so there's already violence implicitly introduced into the equation, because if there's a rule, there has to be somebody who enforces it, and if you don't comply, you know, the threat is always a gun at the end of the decision chain, because if you don't comply with certain fines, you will eventually be in prison. If you try to escape the prison, you will be shot. So that's why it's so important for people to realize, if you're a proponent of any sort of new law or regulation, at the end of that is always a person with a gun. And are you willing to kill for this new rule, even if you, it may be with the best intentions? You know, do see that gun at the end, please. It's so crucial, because it's always there.
Okay, so I agree. And I want a voluntarist utopia just like you, right? But how can that ever come to be? Because there's always going to be someone with a gun. And there's even if it's a minority, there's still going to be the mob, the mafia, you know, the state. I mean, you could class them all as the same kind of tactic, isn't it? Do what I'll protect you, do what I say, and if you don't, I'll hurt you. But how do we get to that point then? Because there's always going to be someone coming in with violence, presumably.
I think, Tim, a lot of it really starts with yourself, and that's why I'm a big proponent of creating the life right now as you want it, and be an architect of your own life within the framework of a society that's arguably not very free, but we still have a lot of wiggle room, you know, and there's still a lot of things where we can truly craft them the way we want. So that's why our interpersonal relationships, the way we raise our children, the way we run our business, that's still largely up to us. So I think it's not so much about waiting for the glorious time in 20 years or 200 years when all the chains will magically fall away. And they might that might never come. But you can kind of live your best life already right now.
All right, then. Let's drill down on a few of those things you said then, the different ways you can do these things. Mm-hmm. Let's start with children, since I've just met one of your children. How do you bring your kids up in a voluntarist way? Or would you call yourself a voluntarist? Or?
Yeah, I would. I do like that. Well, you know, as a parent, there's a lot of challenges, but one thing that's where we can really wonderfully learn from children, because they're born with an innate sense of freedom. They know exactly what they want. They know that, you know, they understand their bodily autonomy. They have very strong will, so they're naturally inclined really to, like, not be governed. They don't like being told what to do. They don't really like to obey very much, unless they think, you know, it's meaningful, unless they think it's purposeful. So you just really have to follow your kids' lead and not break this innate ability that they have to be, like, freedom-loving creatures. So really, the less you do as a parent, honestly, the better, I'm finding.
Really?
You don't really have to teach them very much, because they already know all that. It's maybe your job not to damage that in them, so kind of to follow their lead on that.
How old are your children?
So I have a 2-year-old and an 8-year-old.
And are you're homeschooling them?
So the 8-year-old goes to a community school, which is incidentally right here in our building where we're meeting right now, and it's by her own choice. We tried a couple different kind of setups. She is incredibly social. So she thrives in the company of other children. So she really, really desires that. And this is a school, it actually doesn't, so the state doesn't see it as a school. They see it kind of as like an extracurricular activity. So officially, in the eyes of the government, she is homeschooled. Yet she goes to this community group every day. If she chooses to, I don't force her. That's her decision. She wants to go every day. And if she's ill or so, then she's really sad that she can't go. So she really loves it. So she's as good as homeschooled, but to have like the social circle that she really needs and thrives in, then she does that. And then, of course, the 2-year-old is at home. Yes.
So from what I just gleaned from what you were saying about maybe not intervening in your kid's life, intervening as less as possible. Yeah. Here's my devil's advocate argument for that. Sure. I've got 3 kids, and I know. I mean, my parenting style is possibly different to yours. I'm quite an authoritarian, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. you know,
well,
like
that's a contradiction to what you just said, though.
No. Yeah. I mean, I'll try and convince you that it's not, because I think all these ways of being are relevant in different scenarios, and I think scale is one of the most important things. For example. Sure. in our family of five, we're pretty socialist, really. I mean, I provide, I've got the means of production and I give it away for free to everyone. And I kind of tell the kids what to do. You know, it's just when you scale it, it doesn't work. And because obviously the reason why these systems of governance arise is out of the human condition, isn't it? It's like, it's not, I'm loathed to think that that way is wrong and that way is right. I think in certain situations, yes, maybe true. Like at scale, communism is a terrible idea. But in a family unit with young children, it actually kind of, a version of it kind of works. But that's beside the point. What I was going to say about not intervening in children's lives is my experience of it has been I need to give them a framework within which they can go pretty crazy. Because if I let them take the lead, they'd be on a computer playing video games all day and eating sugar nonstop. You know, it's like I know more than them in many sense, in many senses. I know they are innately, you know, they have an innate intelligence, but also they make terrible decisions if I let them do it. So what's your idea about that, an approach to that, say?
I do agree. Children sometimes make decisions that to us seem terrible. On the other hand, do you really know that it's going to be terrible for them? What's the worst that could happen? You know,
take the example of sugar. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm pretty sure, don't quote me on this, but I heard that children have no way of regulating the amount of, like, if I ate a chocolate bar, afterwards I'm like, right, just keep me away from chocolate, where the kids can just keep going and keep going and keep going. Mm. And we all know sugar's not good for you, you know, refined sugar, it's like, you know. Things like that, or my observation, for example, of there are some, where I live, I think there's probably one family in particular that I know that have allowed their kids to grow up this way. And the parents' lives is very complicated because the kids won't go to bed when they're told, you know, they're like up at midnight, and you know, like that's, I often see that as a kind of plus. Funnily enough, they're not really massively social. I notice your kids really social. As soon as I walk through the door, they start saying hello to me. I obviously see that as a good sign, because saying, for a small child to say hello to a tall man, it's quite scary normally, isn't it? It's
like, yeah, but I would disagree that that's a good sign, because some children are social, some kids are not social. I think it's really important that they're authentic, and if they don't want to say hi to somebody, also the same way when my parents come over and they don't want to hug them, they don't want to kiss them, that's on them. They don't want to say hi, you know, that's quite all right with me. I would much rather have that than the kids where the parents tell them, what do you say, and say hello and say thank you, and that's then they will really never learn how to do that if they're always told what to do. And similarly, I think with the sugar, for example, it's a double-edged sword, because if you're always regulating them, how will they learn to regulate themselves? I mean, you could argue that one way is just like, all right, then just here's a bag of candy and just like go to town and you'll have stomach ache afterwards. So it's really the natural consequences. But of course, I do also regulate my children. It's not that anything goes. We do have rules. And incidentally, voluntarism is not absence of rules, right? It's the absence of rulers. So if there's rules that make sense to you, then naturally do abide by them. And those are needed in any sort of society, even perfectly anarcho-capitalist society will have rules. But there are rules that are, again, like bottom up, that everybody agrees on, that just makes sense, and they're not arbitrarily imposed. So we do have those in the family. It is necessary. And any rule kind of is up for discussion and input. Even from the kids, they kind of have an equal vote. That being said, I will agree with you, Tim. Of course, when the axe comes to the grind, yes, I do put my foot down sometimes. It is necessary. So it's not perfect. Even so, I do try to explain to my kids, like, listen, I'm just really tired. I have to get up tomorrow. Like, I have a meeting. You have to go to bed now. Like, that's it. So it does happen, yeah.
And it's not perfect. And your two-year-old says, sure, see you later. I'm just going to bed.
Well, no, but then, I mean, I don't drag her to bed, like, kicking and screaming. But, like, we turn off the light and we go to sleep together. It kind of all works. And I I rarely raise my voice at the kids. I do it sometimes. I'm not going to pretend it's never happened. I would never hit them ever in my life. Like
that seems pretty obvious.
Yeah. But again, rules, yes.
Rulers, no.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So about your point of forcing them to say hello or not. Here's my devil's advocate on that, because we do that. Mm. And I tell you why we do that, because many of a young child's impressions of themselves come from their interactions with other people, especially adults. And I think if you turn off, in inverted commas, a load of adults, I think it can reflect back on you and you think there must be something wrong with me. And teaching your child to just do those simple things, which adults really appreciate normally, then I think that if they are the liked person by, and I'm not saying you have to be a liked person, but when you are liked or you are a good person is reflected back at them at a young age, they sort of soak it up. By the time they get to 16, 17, 18, there's a foundation of, yeah, I'm a good person.
Oh, I disagree very strongly with that. I see what you're saying, but I think that you're... idea of self-worth should never come from other people. I think it's a very slippery slope. And as a person who suffered from that a large part of my life, where I needed that external validation and I needed other people's approval, I kind of was a people pleaser for a long time. And that's something that I'm trying to shed now. And I think that really plays into that you have to be nice so that other people like you to make you feel good about yourself.
Okay, yeah, that would be the downside of it. Mm. I think, but don't you think children are this kind of, they're like these learning machines, aren't they?
Sure, yeah.
And if I'm pretty sure that it's normal to notice your surroundings and say, why is no one talking to me, or why aren't people being nice to me, or what, you know, then it's obviously self-reflective to go, maybe I'm doing something that's not making people want to talk to me. I mean,
that would then be the lesson that they will learn. And I think any lesson that they learn naturally in life is 100 times more valuable than what you tell them as a parent. Do this, do that. And they're just told. They never had the firsthand experience. If truly what happens, if what you're saying happens, that they grow up to be like a recluse or they're alienated from society, you know, then they at least have learned the hard way and they will truly internalize that lesson. Versus just being told. And the same is with the candy, right? Natural consequences, stomach ache, or I have no friends. Well, I better change something about that. And that's coming from me. It's my own impulse and not me being told.
Why do you think you had, you were an overly people-pleasing?
I was because, and to a certain extent, you know, something I still grapple with a little bit, because that was like instilled in me to be like the nice girl, to be the good girl. And again, like I had amazing parents, so there's no way like a reproach towards them. But I think society also kind of demands that of you. And there's a lot of kind of unspoken like lessons that you get handed down along the way. So it is actually a burden if you don't truly know yourself, and then you navigate life like based on other people's expectations, and like you avoid conflict. It's very unhealthy to try to avoid conflict. So that's something that I'm learning, like in my 30s, to actually welcome conflict, approach it in an intelligent way, and to not be afraid to piss people off. Frankly, you know, because I'm not here to make friends with everybody. I'm really here for myself. So to be my own advocate, and I think if I can teach my children that already now, well. Again, correction, not teach them that, like maintain that in them, because they are born with that naturally to be their own advocate. They scream if you do something that you don't like, you know, they run away from you. They know how to stand up for themselves. You can crush that in them, certainly. So I don't want to do that.
That I think the collectivists amongst us would say what you're doing there is socializing your children to work within the framework of society.
Right, right, right.
So obviously... Not you're not a great fan of that idea.
I do think it's so important to have social skills to get along with other people, because having a connection with another human being, that's really the most beautiful thing that we can experience in life. You know, we're social creatures. So it is so important to do that, but not at our own expense.
Do you, I mean, here's the other thing about homeschooling for me, or sort of this not homeschooling, but not being in... What are the state schools like here, by the way? Are they something that you really don't want to have any part of? Is that...
I went to a state school here, of course. I was educated up until like my teenage years. That's when I went to Germany. But I went through all the state school here. Actually, because my parents were quite enlightened, they sent me to really nice, like, select schools that were a little bit more forward-thinking, a little bit more modern, but still in the same of like traditional education. So you're sitting down, teacher is talking at you and telling you what you should know, and then eventually they test you. And if you don't know the stuff they told you, then you get a bad grade and that there's a problem. So really the most traditional. And of course, everywhere in the Western world, education systems are trying to kind of reform themselves. But it just cosmetic changes. They don't tackle the fact that children naturally are driven to learn. Like you said, they're learning machines. And they know exactly what they want to be learning. But schools don't teach them that. They teach them some other stuff based on some kind of fairly arbitrary curricula. And then you get, you know, negative consequences for not knowing those curricula, which is hugely demotivating. I mean, if the findings of psychology for the last 50 years have taught us anything, is that grades do not work. And if you want to kill the love of learning in children and demotivate them, make them perform worse, then you should grade them. Well, what are we doing? We're grading children. You know, it's hugely counterproductive, big mistake.
More and more as well.
Yeah.
I think the other thing about the way that schools exist currently, state schools especially, is technology has made them redundant. Because even memorizing stuff now is completely
pointless. Absolutely.
And yes, the correct way is obviously to teach your children how to find the answer to something, correct, not the answer itself.
Right.
But okay, so here's a conversation I started to get into with someone yesterday that I didn't follow far enough. Transhumanism. You know what transhumanism,
yeah,
right? So we're already kind of doing a version of it, right? We've got a phone in our hand.
Suppose, yes.
Yeah, right. So, okay, well, the natural progression of that is phone, you know, technology embedded in your consciousness, say,
yeah,
somehow.
Mm.
Which I think is the natural evolution of all of this stuff. Because like we say, okay, 100 years ago, the schooling system taught you to memorize things because that you kind of had to, you needed to necessarily.
Yeah.
Now you don't need to. Mm. It's obvious that you could be a far more competent human being if you integrated that technology, i.e. Google search or whatever it is, into your body.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you got an opinion on transhumanism? Because it's something that I feel uneasy about it. I don't like the idea of it. But when you look at it, it's like, but who's going to not do that? There's always going to be a bunch of people that do it. And if you get left behind, who are you?
Yeah, I mean, I think as libertarians, we always see the danger of that being hijacked. And we know that the technology you mentioned already, we have phone in our hands, and we know that it's been hijacked by the government to really instill like a surveillance state, you know, and imagine that being implanted in our brains. Where does that leave us? And, you know, they're already ushering in digital IDs and CBDCs. And we know this is really just the next step in kind of the agenda of truly ushering in totalitarian, like, technological state, a global state at that. And I'm sure that's in the works. I'm convinced of that. So I'd be very, very wary of it. At the same time, once the cat is out of the bag, like you said, you know, people are going to probably want that. So I don't really know how to approach that yet. Once that happens, I think I'm going to form an opinion. As long as it's voluntary, of course, then anything goes. And I'm not going to stop anybody from chipping themselves. I would not be the first one to do that. I wouldn't want it.
It's almost certainly going to be voluntary.
Hmm.
But just like the internet is voluntary.
Got it, yeah.
You can't order your food online without using the internet. So, and in another 50 years, that may be something you do with your eye by sort of winking your eye or something calling up the Amazon. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know. Mm. It's a really tricky one because the obvious outcome is a two-tiered society.
Yeah.
And I have nothing against being in the I'm not augmented tier of society. Mm. I'd probably be happy just digging the land on a farm somewhere.
I would be too. I feel
maybe,
like, yeah.
But would we really? You know, like when you follow that through, I live on a farm at the moment, and what used to be a farm, not a farm anymore.
Mm.
And there's no way I could farm because I do other things, you know, like it doesn't, and it's almost like I'd probably sin too much of non-farming to ever be the person that would be tied down to working every day on a farm, which you have to. You can't just do farming 6 months a year. You have to do it all the time. You know?
Yeah.
So what, I don't know. Where do we...
Well, it's very difficult to predict the future, and most of future predictions have always gone wrong. So I'm not big into futurology, but we can... kind of extrapolate what we've seen in the past. What will probably happen? Yes, this technology will come, and with it, the state surveillance will kind of increase. But at the same time, voluntarist efforts to counteract that surveillance state will also increase. So there will sort of be a middle ground. Like you can use your phone and use all the VPNs and all the privacy apps to maintain kind of your individual freedom in that realm. And it's going to be a push and pull from both sides. You know, I think this battle really will never end between the overlords that want to control us and our urge to maintain our freedom. So I think we can maybe just dance kind of like on the in the middle or on the edge as we do now and get the positive stuff out of technology and try to keep the negative stuff at bay.
Someone said to me yesterday on this podcast that all the great stories of human history are libertarian. They're all the story of someone fighting against a power. Do you think that's true? Mm-hmm. I mean, he started by talking about Dune. Do you know the book Dune?
Yeah, I'm actually just reading the book.
Oh, are you? Right. Well, and obviously, in particular, science fiction plays on that.
Lord of the Rings, of course.
Of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, is striving for freedom part of the human condition then?
Definitely. And that's why, because I observe children and I know that they're innately born with a desire for freedom. They're like freedom thriving creatures. So we're all that, you know, that's the natural human state. And that's what we're trying to get back to. Nobody likes being told what to do. I really don't believe anybody does. Maybe in some like specific situations, but we like to be advocates and architects of our lives. And that is the most satisfying when you can really craft your life and then also take full responsibility for that. Maybe that's my cognitive bias because I'm like that. So I think everybody is like that. But I can't imagine that it would be otherwise.
So how do you manifest that then if you're in a scenario where the outside world is pretty oppressive?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it all starts with yourself and your own mind, which is I found in the era of COVID, you know, where I suddenly woke up in a totalitarian society where I was told when I could go outside and where to shop and who to meet, etc. And I really, truly, greatly suffered through that time because it was like that was my hell. And I realized that any freedom actually in the external world can be taken away from me at the turn of a key. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. So really the only true freedom we have is within our mind. I learned that the hard way. And I learned that to really be free, you have to be in command of your mind and what you put in it. And then, even in the worst circumstances, you can still live as a free person.
I've not read it, but the Gulag Archipelago goes into that, does he not?
Yeah.
Doesn't he? Have you read it?
A long, long time ago. Sorry, was it?
I know, it's my phone. I was waiting for a gap.
Yeah.
It's my children sending me emojis. I'm almost certain of it. It's Saturday morning, isn't
it? That's cute.
They've got up. Shall I just go and turn it on briefly?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we can get back to Archipelago.
They're only allowed 1 hour of technology on a Saturday morning, and it's that time.
Okay.
It's exactly at the right time.
And they're using that to message you. Well, that's very nice.
Yeah, amongst other things. They're not allowed to miss. They're only allowed to message people we vetted as being a positive impact on their lives.
Wow, okay.
I know, I told you, we're pretty authoritarian, but not forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, my theory, of course, is that over the next 10 years, I start letting the restrictions down slowly as they leave the nest. Mm-hmm. But I've seen a lot of data on, for example, we'll go back to Solzhenitsyn in a minute. I've seen too much data on social media as being very damaging, especially to young girls. And I've got two young girls. Mm-hmm. And it's very obvious why. And I'll tell you, if children are having problems with interpersonal relationships outside the home, if you allow them on social media, those problems will come into the home and stay there 24 hours a day, because there can always be a message on social media from someone. And not only that, even when there aren't messages, the thought is still there that, oh, why isn't that person messaging me? Or what? You know what I mean? So we put a fence around our house and said, doesn't come in here. This is our safe place. In this house, it's us. It's you, it's your brothers and sisters. It's our family. And that's my theory. I mean, I'm making this up as I go along, I know too many instances of very intelligent, technologically powerful people not letting their kids go on social media. Yeah. So
and I think that's fair game. So when I, for example, spoke about like not having a ton of restrictions, so my 8-year-old, she has an iPad, and I just don't put apps on there that I don't want her to use.
Sure.
So that's my way of, and then like whatever is on there, like sure, go to town. But I would not put TikTok and those things. If she asked me to get that, I would have probably a big conversation with her about it. And I think that I would hopefully be persuasive enough for her like to stop wanting it. Because I think that those kind of social media, Instagram, stuff like that, that does not belong in the hands of young children. 100%.
Especially, I'm not even sure. I mean, I've lived through the whole digital age from the beginning. Like I've very obviously noticed how narcissistic most people are becoming, because we never used to take pictures of ourselves. I don't think I've ever taken I haven't really ever taken a picture of myself anyway, but when you were young, you never turned the camera on yourself. It didn't even occur to you to do it. But if you were just to peruse Instagram now, there's a really big thing is look at me, or I'm in Prague. Like when I was a kid, we'd take a picture of the castle. Now you take a picture of yourself on a selfie stick with the castle behind you.
Yeah, and I think that actually ties nicely to like what we mentioned before, like the need for validation, because really why you're doing that is to get the likes and get the external approval for your looks, for your beautiful lifestyle, for how rich you are, etc. So
yes,
that is that, you know, reflected. And if you have people who need that external validation, then they do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, how does that end then? Like where are we going with that, and how do we mitigate against that?
In our kids, you mean?
Well, in society. Does it matter?
I don't need to mitigate anything in society. I really just like, I just care about, well, I do care about the society, but I don't want to tell society what to do. But I do think that it starts just like with yourself, like really be the change you want to see in the world. I believe in that.
Yeah.
So I just like clean up my own front door in my house and try to raise my kids like not to need those things and not to turn to other people for like how they should act. And I believe that I'm making that change, you know, by changing my life.
So if you're the clean your front door type of person, how do you feel about living amongst people that don't clean their front door, or moving to a place where everyone cleans their front door?
Again, I think that if you do your work, if you work on your own mind, then you can live anywhere and be happy. That doesn't mean we don't want to change our external circumstance for the better. Of course we do. That's why we're building parallel structures. That's why we're building free cities. I applaud all those efforts. I love all those efforts. They're so important. At the same time, I think equally important, if not more so, is, you know, cultivating a mindset where you don't totally depend on those structures, because any structure can collapse. Anything can happen. I talked about futurology. We never know what will happen in the future. One thing that you do know is you're going to be with yourself for the rest of your life. So that's where you need to do the work.
So if there was the option in 25 years, say the Free Cities movement had evolved into a number of satellite places around the world, would you hold tight where you are and continue as per normal? You've traveled a lot, right?
Yes.
Would you cast yourself how long have you been settled here?
Here for 4 years. And before that, we moved around for a couple of years. We lived in Hungary, we lived in Portugal and the US a little bit.
What was the point of that? Was there a reason just traveling?
Shake shit up, literally. Yeah. I mean, I love that. And it's also like puts you in out of your comfort zone. which is just, it's a brilliant experience. And we did that, you know, starting our business and having a small kid. So it was a really, really fun time. I would recommend that to everybody. And especially because, again, because it is very uncomfortable. So it pushes you. Those are the growing experiences.
Did you start your business while you were traveling?
Correct. Yes.
Wow.
Because it's fully online. So as I mean, a lot of startups, you know, they're not location specific. So it gives you that freedom.
I should mention you've got a very cool business. I'm looking at one of them now. You make customized amps.
Guitar pedals.
Sorry, but you are going to start making amps as well.
Correct. Yes.
But that doesn't sound very impressive. But if you saw them, you'd know they're all like limited edition, done by
hand printed and artists. Basically hand assembled.
They're very, very cool. And I mean, it's normally when you hear people say, "Yeah, I've got an online business." I often get a bit disappointed when I find out what it is, but this one really is cool, and you seem to be doing pretty well on the back of it. It's a good life.
It's a great life. It took us a long time to build that up to this point where we're very comfortable, and most importantly, we really have a lot of fun with it. The beauty of doing limited editions is that you do a run, it's gorgeous, it sells out, and then you're done, and then you can move on to the next project.
Yeah.
So you don't really fall into like the inertia and just like going on autopilot. Like you're again constantly challenged, and you can constantly be creative. And you said they're beautiful. Thank you for saying that. So we put a lot of effort into the design.
Are.
So really, I think it's so important for people to create. So this is a lot of like a creative outlet for us to be able to do that and choose the colors and the artwork that goes with it.
It does your particular ideology mean that you will never scale it to a huge, you're not interested in turning it into a sort of, I don't know, a huge organization or whatever, you know, is it, I mean, I know that from myself. See, there was there's always a ceiling to how much I ever want to work, and it kind of corresponds to an amount of money, and it's like, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
We kind of stop there. I value time massively,
100%.
Especially now I've got children, obviously, and so I would never. I have friends who started companies like 20 years ago, now have 500 employees, and they're millions, of, you know, but they're very stressed, and they're very, you know, and I know that. When I see them driving a better car than me, it might hurt a little bit, but really at the end of the day, I'm like so happy that I managed to carve out an existence which was is independent, a self-sovereign individual.
And the ultimate wealth is time, and it's your freedom. So if you give that up in exchange for money, to me, that's not a good trade. I agree with you. I know how much money I know I need to make to be comfortable, and I don't need more. I'm not going to eat, double the burgers, or what am I going to get? Like an extra couch. Don't need that. So to us, like I work about 2 hours every day, really almost every day. I mean, including weekends, but that's it. And I don't look for 8-hour work days to make four times the money. I don't need that. I value my time, value my freedom, even time to do nothing. Such a luxury. I love
it. So how do you end up starting a company that makes custom guitar pedals, and especially when you're traveling? Presumably you went traveling to just hang out and see a bit of Europe.
Well, we had a baby, and then we thought, you know, we need to move, because Prague is such a comfortable place to live. I mean, if you speak with anybody, they will probably tell you, like, the cost of living for the comfort you get here is unparalleled in the world, at least that I've seen. It's very safe. It's very easy to navigate. So it's such an easy city to like get stuck in, which obviously has happened to me. Look, here I am. But before that, we had a baby, and we just said, hey, like, let's change things up and let's just move to a place we've never been before. Just get an Airbnb and go. And then we're starting the business. And my goodness, like, there were for sure challenges, like financial in the family, like coming to grips with like having a little baby, learning all those things. But it was also like some of the most fun time of my life. I wouldn't change it. So whenever any of my friends comes to me like, hey, I have an opportunity to relocate, I'm like, do it, move away, do something completely different.
But
time
you,
will never come again.
You settled back down in Prague. Is that because you're Czech? Or for the reasons you just stated?
Yeah, that was not the primary reason. I think there is what I just said. Because if I look at all the capitals in Europe, like I love Berlin, I really love Lisbon, love Budapest, but all criteria that matter to me, Prague just wins across the board.
What about as far as freedom goes? Do you got an opinion on other places?
Yeah, I do think there's still a really huge level of freedom. Like, for the most part, you can get a beer, walk around in Prague, you know, have like a bonfire in the forest. Like, for the most part, nobody will bother you. Yes, it's getting more restrictive than it used to be. But I just spoke to somebody from the UK, where you're from, and they said, oh, you guys like have bonfires here? That's illegal in the UK, and kids can be around it. And I just thought it's so sad. Like, come on.
It is. I used to have an apartment in Berlin years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Prenzlauer Berg, I remember.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah. And going there I had the same experience. I'll never forget that, you know, I went to one of the local parks in Berlin. We went to the Reichstag when we first got there. And there were people having barbecues on the grass there. And you know, like families sitting under Parliament. I'm not being funny, but if you did that in the UK, there'd be a SWAT team swoop in and just scoop you up and tell you what you're doing.
Which is particularly funny because the Reichstag in Berlin has a tendency of being set on fire. Yeah. But they still allow that. No, that's beautiful. I have a similar experience. I was walking through Berlin. It was about 7 years ago, through a park, and it opened up to a clearing. There was a bunch of people naked. Yeah. It was just a nudist section of the park.
That's right.
And I loved it. Yeah. That's freedom to me, you know, being butt naked and barbecuing. Like, yes. That's humanity at its best.
Yeah, I know. Which, and also surprising, because I don't think the rest of Germany is like that. Berlin you could consider it a little bit of a bubble like that.
Yes, that's correct. But so in the south, obviously, or Bavaria, it's quite different. I mean, it's a massive country. It's, 80 million people. So you're naturally going to have, like, massive differences. Berlin is fantastic like that. Although I do feel like it's getting a little more hijacked by the, like, woke crowd. I don't know. That was my impression last couple of times I went. I don't know what you thought.
I haven't been for a while, but I don't know. I don't know. It's not something I pay much attention to. Okay. I know that people... I think I told you this story before about the fire brigade on our street. Did I tell you that?
I don't think so, this is
the perfect example of what I'm talking about, because we lived near Mauer Park in Prenzlauer Berg.
Yeah.
We were right next to the park, mm-hmm. but you know, one of those kind of, you know, they're lovely streets.
Yeah, same as here. Mm-hmm.
And there's a fire station on our street, a big fire station, a working fire station. And it was one of those streets where every couple of days, parties would just spring up in the summer. Do you know what I mean?
Amazing.
Anyway, one day we were in the back house of one of those apartment buildings. I walked out of, you know, those big doors you get on the front of the houses. And there was a massive party going on. The whole, it had kind of like taken over the whole street. It was just techno and people dancing in the sun. And the fire brigade came out, turned on the engines or whatever, pointed the things up in the air and just sprayed everyone with rain, you know, and it was like people were going nuts and everyone was having, and there's, you know, I know I come from a more of a reserved culture, I suppose, but that would never happen, especially the fire brigade, because they are, you know, you consider, there's no individual choice. Like, no fireman in the UK would say, hey, this would be cool. Mm. Let's do this. Because the pressure to conform to, no, you can't do that, you know.
And how sad is that? Because it takes away so much.
Well, sure.
Because the best part of being human is, like, just having fun and being spontaneous. You know, that's why we're here, to just enjoy. So I applaud those firemen.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, me too.
Yeah.
Everyone applauded them.
Yeah,
it was nice.
Sure. Everybody likes that. You know, at the end of the day, I think if you ask every person on earth, like, individually, do you think that's fun? Like, 80% or more would say yes. Yet, somehow, in some places, you're not allowed to do that, even though the majority wants it. Like, what the hell is going on?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's the top-down governance is a very persuasive.
But I do think that even the people in power would think that's fun, no?
No.
They would not.
Absolutely not.
No.
A good example, I spoke to a couple of days ago one of the founders of Parallelnypolis.
Yeah.
And we talked a lot about their art collective and some of the things they did. And if there was ever an example of the powers that be not getting the joke, and not, is that thing with the red shorts?
The shorts, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's my example, right? Once again, the people in power don't get the joke. And he showed me the video of them burning it 2 years later, which is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life.
It was brilliant because that's actually what like elevated the shorts to such an iconic status. Like he did that, the president himself. So he really did the opposite of what he intended.
Of course. But that's what I'm talking about. They don't get it. I think the kind of mentality that puts you in a position of power that is very... I mean, that's why often authoritarians ban comedy, isn't it? It's like ban the humor is the truth often.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Like the jester in the court's the only one that can actually say what's happening. You know?
And the Czechs know that quite well. I mean, I think that one of our national features is that we'd like to make fun of everything quite a lot. I think it was Himmler. He was the Reich's protector when this was basically occupied, right? During Third Reich. And he called the Czech like the laughing beasts because they just make fun of everything, even under the most cruel regime. They would find ways to like sneak humor, and that was the language of really the resistance.
Hmm. Well, it is. Yeah. It is the truth. The last bastion of truth often is
correct.
Comedy.
And I often find libertarians should get a little better at like making good memes and little funny videos, because a lot of it is kind of serious, highbrowy, intellectual message that we're sending out into the world, and it's important to speak the language of the masses, which is memes nowadays, right? I get my news from memes. I'm like, if it's not a meme, it wasn't an important event enough.
So who is good at memes then? I mean, look, I don't think the left wing's very good at memes. I don't think the right wing's very good at memes. Who's making all these memes then? Because there's some funny memes out there. I think it is libertarians.
You think so?
Well, like,
where'd you get your good libertarian memes?
Well,
tell me the source.
For example, what is shitposting on the internet? Mm. What is that? Who's doing that? Who are these people that are just creating a little bit of chaos on the internet once they see someone being serious and being self-absorbed and being not self-reflective? They just go in for the kill. It's a very instinctual thing to do. Mm-hmm. Who are they? They're libertarians, aren't they? Aren't they people that, you know, anyone... Well, put it this way. The left wing says the right wing can't make a joke, and the right wing says the left wing can't make a joke.
I suppose, yeah.
So it must be the middle that's making all the jokes.
Yes.
I think so. I mean, I laugh continuously.
Power to them. I mean, I love that stuff also. We need humor, and it's so healing, you know. And even like during the darkest times of COVID, like honestly, like having a good meme, it gives you that little dopamine serotonin kick that you need to get through the next hours. So I love that stuff.
Let's go back to what you were saying. We didn't finish that
conversation
about lockdowns. Mm-hmm. And then I want to go back to traveling as well. About living within a system that is oppressive from the outside, but working on your inner sense of freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, it is crucial. I cannot stress it enough, because again, that's the one thing that cannot be taken away from you. Any structure that you build is by definition temporary in the outside world. And we have to view it as such, you know, and then not be disappointed if those things collapse. But really, the freedom you have between the ears, that is yours to keep forever. That's why we have to cultivate it. That has to be the priority. And you were mentioning Solzhenitsyn and the Gulag Archipelago, how he talks about like finding freedom even in the most dire situations. Similarly, a very, very famous book is by Viktor Frankl, A Man's Search for Meaning. So he was an Austrian psychiatrist, and he went through the Holocaust. He went through all the camps, Auschwitz. His wife was killed, etc. And he writes at length. The whole book really is about that. When you're in hell, you can still... One thing that you're in control of is your attitude and your mind. And you can find a little bit of freedom there. And that's really where liberty starts and ends. That's the last bastion that you're in ownership of. So I think finding the tools to foster that, to nourish that within you, that will get you through anything, because then you will never lose hope.
So what are those tools then?
Those tools are, first of all, being aware that you have a mind, that something goes on in it, and it's not always necessarily true. So the old adage, don't believe everything you think, that to me, to truly realize that, internalize that, was a game changer. Because you are constantly, there's a stream of consciousness going on in your mind. And a lot of the times it tends to be negative, especially if things going in the external world, like let's say during COVID, would probably be very negative for almost everybody, because half of the people are terrified of COVID, the other half are terrified of government intervention. So you're terrified, so you're constantly bombarded with these negative thoughts. And it's so liberating to actually realize, okay, these things are like going through my mind, and I don't have to listen to them. I can turn them off. I can be in a place that's still, because right now in this particular moment, there's probably no threat. I'm probably fine. And that's going to be true in 99% of scenarios where you're actually totally safe and your life is actually pretty good. The sun is shining. You're still breathing. You're fine. Yet our mind tends to default to torturing us with some horrendous scenarios. And what if, and what are these people in power doing? And why don't we have anarcho-capitalism yet? Or why am I not in Honduras, in Prospera, you know, living my best life? So
isn't that denial though? Like, isn't that you, isn't that the frog, isn't that you being the frog in a pot of boiling water?
No, not
saying,
at all.
Saying everything's fine, I'm free, I'm free. And then
but you are.
All right, but then you end up in behind bars, say.
So if a situation requires your action, a more intelligent, informed action will always come from this place of like, first of all, calm down. Calm your thoughts. If you're going to be so reactive and like reacting from panic, it's not going to be an intelligent action anyway. It's mostly going to be defensive or aggressive. It's going to end up hurting you. So if you want to change your external circumstance, again, you still have to default to like going in your mind, calming yourself, finding that freedom that is actually within you. And if that sounds too spiritual, well, perhaps it is. But to me, that's like what got me through COVID. And it gave me so much strength going forward. So now I'm really not so afraid of like, what are the next regulations or what's going to happen with digital IDs and CBDCs. I know I'm going to be okay.
What if, though, most people don't care about that? You said earlier that no one likes to be told what to do. Mm. I think there's tons of people that like to be told what to do. Don't even like, they just kind of want it. You know, we all know what the trade is. The trade is, if I do what I'm told, life becomes simpler. It's the root of taking less responsibility.
So they just like comfort.
Responsibility is a burden, as we know. I think the secret of responsibility, of understanding, is understanding that that burden is meaning. Mm. But if you don't, it's very easy to go, okay, great, if I can just offset that burden to this organization or this state, then life is simpler. And it is simpler. I mean, look, take the classic example of this is the vaccination, which was so polarizing amongst people. Some people took it, some people didn't. But if you didn't take it, the pressure to take it was massive until it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Until it suddenly wasn't, there
suddenly
was no pressure.
Matter.
Right, exactly. But during the time when it did, in inverted commas, matter, the easiest thing for you to do if you were someone that chose not to is just take it. And then all of a sudden, bang, it's gone. That pressure, or the same with masks. You might have been someone who didn't believe in wearing masks.
Right.
But when you walked into the shop without a mask on, even if someone didn't say anything to you, the pressure of people looking and the shop.
Yeah, external pressure and needing people's validation and needing to people please. So that was very much amplified. And I mean, in the beginning, I did mask. Then I realized this goes against everything I believe in. And it's actually more harmful to me to put the mask on because I feel like I'm a fraud and I'm just playing the game. So it was easier for me to take it off. And it wasn't by no means easy or comfortable. That I agree with. But I felt like if I did mask, I'm actually hurting myself more in the long run because I'm hurting my integrity towards myself. I'm being dishonest towards myself. So it was much easier in the long run, like not to pretend and deal with some glares, comments, like getting kicked out of places. Sure. Like that at the end of the day was still easier to me than to be a fake.
Isn't that a personality type though? That
probably.
That, I mean, no, I mean the people pleasing side. I have that side. And that makes it very, like you say, uncomfortable to go against the grain.
Yeah.
There's a part of me, I have the merry prankster side of me that as soon as I feel that feeling, I have to, like if someone says, don't say that, I can't help myself. It literally, under my breath, I have to say that.
Yeah. It's the contrarian
right.
in you.
Yeah. Right, okay. But it doesn't mean that I'll ever be able to change that side of myself that wants to please people. Like it is, it feels so innate. It feels, not that I could say I've been to the depth of my soul to sort of investigate, but it does seem like, because that personality trait is also a good thing, obviously.
Agreed. And that's where you have to, I think, explore a little bit. Hey, is it something that I'm benefiting from, or is it something that's harming me? If it's something that's benefiting, feels good, then by all means, like, we're not going to recreate our whole personalities just to, like, create something that's more authentic. No, there's lots in my personality also that I like and that I'm keeping. People pleasing is maybe also a spectrum, because there's a benefit in getting a good rapport with people, getting along with people well, and therefore, like, maybe even, like, manipulating social interactions to your advantage, not in an insidious way, but sort of, you know, to go get through life easy, and that's great. But when it starts to be at your own expense, when you can't say no to people and you cannot deny your authentic feelings, when that, obviously that's harmful. So that needs to be then investigated and curbed.
So let's go back to a little bit about more of your nomadic existence. Did you think of it like that when you were doing it? Did you think we're just... I mean, a lot of people take on that kind of lifestyle. A lot of libertarians do,
yeah,
because they know it makes them far less governable. Me personally, I just went traveling. I wanted to see the world. Why did you go?
Literally just to see the world and to, like, challenge myself and to have that blank slate where you come to a new country, you don't know the language, you don't know anything, and you can kind of reinvent yourself a little bit in that. So that is, it's a very, very liberating feeling. I've always loved to travel. I spent some time in Asia, even just like when I was in Asia backpacking, I just went by myself, like Cambodia, Thailand, you know, those are still relatively, of course, like very safe countries. I'm not saying I did anything crazy, but it was one of the coolest experiences of my life just to, like, have a map, a little bit of money and a backpack and just go for it. And because I thrive in freedom, doing that gave me, like, unlimited sense of freedom. Like, nobody knows or cares where I'm sleeping that night, where I'm going to go the next day. It's beautiful. And also, you can show to yourself, like, I can do that. You know, there's some challenges, I can overcome them. So it makes you feel very strong, gives you a lot of confidence. That's why those experiences are just so lovely. And you benefit from that for the rest of your life because you have such amazing memories. And that's what traveling really does, like the right kind of traveling.
I did, I've done it a number of times throughout my life. But when I left London, I was working in London for 7 years at a newspaper. And I can still remember to this day, because I had to get out kind of thing. You know, like, it was like a elastic band that was being pulled. When I finally left, I got a one-way ticket to Mumbai. Mm. And I remember getting on the plane and I knew I had one bag as well. And I know that feeling. I mean, there have been two times in my life where I felt the freest. One was when I was in my early 20s traveling, and then I did it again in my 30s. Mm. and it was the same. Mm. And it really, when I look at it, it was a lack of external responsibility.
Mm.
But that's not always a good thing. Like, I know, you know, like, I have huge responsibility now with children, for funding, in a lifestyle of people, you know, like, it's like, and I do miss that feeling, but I would never trade it for what I've got now, because they're both very valid. Mm. Is that something we go through then, like traveling? Like, for example, when you came back home, was that a conscious decision, or did you just end up here, you know?
Yeah, we just kind of ended up here, and I don't have a life that I need to escape from. So those interludes were really wonderful to me. Now my life is also wonderful. And now we're talking about maybe going somewhere again for 2 months, you know, just for a change of scenery. Of course, during COVID, nobody really traveled. And then we had a little baby, so we're, like, grounded because of that a little bit. But we have also occasionally done, like, we spent 2 months in Valencia one summer. And I do like that long traveling where it's at least a month in one place. But what you were saying, the lack of external responsibility is very fantastic, I think, in the long run, because you're also isolated. So I don't think it's a condition that we would thrive in the long run. Like, we do crave for connection with other people. So not having any external responsibility, I don't think that's a good human condition to have for, like, years and years.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know that person, you meet them traveling, they've been traveling too long.
Correct.
And they are often single, yeah. I've noticed.
The lone wolf.
Which is interesting as well, because, yeah, arguably, I'm probably going to offend a lot of people here when I say this, but being single, I won't even say it. Being single in your later years through choice is an interesting choice, let's say.
It is.
It's an interesting
or diagnosis.
Well, whatever. I mean, I know people do make that choice.
Yeah.
But it does signify something because yeah. when you, you know, and certainly even the notion of having a long-term partnership with someone, it's not easy. No, everyone knows that. It's super difficult. No, you know, no one gives you the rules and regulations before you start. In fact, they do. They give you the wrong ones, I think.
That's correct. I agree with that 100%.
But,
well, do you want to talk about like the relationship structures and maybe something that goes against the grain, like a parallel structure to the mainstream?
Sure. I mean, you call that ethical non-monogamy.
Correct. Correct.
So why don't you explain what ethical non-monogamy is then first?
Right.
I mean, it seems pretty obvious, actually. Now I hear it out loud.
Yeah, it is what it says, Tim.
Right, okay. It is what it says on the tin.
Yeah, so exactly. So there's also different approaches to it, but by and large, it means that you're not monogamous with your partner, and it's ethical in the sense that there's consensus. There's two consenting adults that say we are in a romantic relationship, but it's not a monogamous one.
So what's the difference between that ethical non-monogamy and, I don't know, polygamy or, I don't know, what all the other things people call it.
Yeah, this would be probably the umbrella term. I mean, when you have polygamy in countries where polygamy is legal, then it's not the same probably as ethical non-monogamy because this is truly a consensus of like two adults that come to a drawing table and structure the relationship the way what they want. Obviously, in polygamous countries, like you're not really given the choice. It's just how it is culturally. Just like it is in our culture with monogamy, which is the default, and it's not truly meant to be questioned. It's kind of frowned upon if you do other stuff.
Do you think personally then that monogamy is unnatural, or do you think it's natural for some people and not for others? Or?
That's what I think. I think that people have different preferences. For some people, they're perfectly happy in monogamous relationships. I think a lot of people are not, which is why we also see... we see that every day in the media, you know, cheating scandals and marriage is broken up because of that and like the level of deception. And I'm sure like we all have friends, we talk with them, you know, it's very, very rare that people would be like truly actually monogamous without ever like breaking that bond or breaking that unspoken promise or spoken. So I do think for a majority of people, it's actually a little bit unnatural in the long run.
What about the idea then that... monogamy evolved culturally for good reasons. I think it did. I think it obviously did.
Well, what were the reasons? I mean, mostly property rights, right? To ensure that your progeny is truly yours. Therefore, you limit like access to the female to make sure that the offspring is yours and you can pass on your property to them. That was one of the reasons. There's many other reasons. And it's actually, when you dig into the history of monogamy, are humans truly naturally monogamous or not? There is quite a lot of debate on that with academics. Monogamy apparently is quite rare with animals.
Yeah, I think so.
And even in human societies, they're not all monogamous. I mean, there is alternatives to that, even in like the tribes, you know, that still live kind of the original way of life, like tribal, there is still different approaches. There's monogamy, there is polygamy, there is basically, there's differences.
There are. I've seen them many times. I was making films in those kind of places for a long time.
Yeah.
And one that springs to mind immediately is in Niger, the Wadabi tribe, who have... I don't know what it's called. I don't think it's called polygamy or whatever, but...
Polyandry is when it's, multiple husbands to a wife.
It's not even... I'm not even sure it's husbands and wives. I think it's just you're allowed... It's more like what you're describing. Mm. We made a film at an event that they have often, a gathering where the men all have to line up and dance for the women and the women pick the guys they like.
Yeah,
and
okay.
It's fascinating to watch. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was an outsider, of course. But
you didn't have to dance.
Well, no, we danced, yeah. I mean, everyone was dancing all night. It went on for 5 days.
Oh, fun. But that's a lot of dancing, Tim.
You know, well, it's basically being in a circle, jumping up and down and going around. But what's fascinating about it is, amongst other things... the men beautify themselves to appeal to the women, which is often the other way around.
Yeah.
But in a way, I would say, This often goes untalked about in sort of relationships. Actually, I see the relationship dynamic as men jostling for position to appeal to the highest value female anyway. Mm. That's kind of what happens. That when you're a man, every man knows that in the dating pool, it's like the best guy gets the catch, if you see what I mean. But they're not the catcher. The final word always seems to reside with the woman. It's the woman that chooses. What you do is you jostle for position to present yourself, which is what was happening in these things. And that's how I've always seen it. Certainly when you're younger anyway, when men are, you know, women are in their prime, let's say in your 20s or whatever it is. Most people think it the other way around. They think these men going out sort of like, you know, asking girls out and like, it's always asking.
So what you're saying that from a man, there's always an implicit yes, and then the woman can be yes or no.
Yes, I think so. Well, that you see that on dating apps, yeah. I'm told. I mean, unfortunately, they arose after I was off the market years before that. But that's what Tinder is. And in fact, isn't the best app now that everyone uses Bumble or whatever it is? Women can respond.
Correct. They can initiate the conversation. So they just sold Bumble for some like insane amount of money. So obviously that's doing well. I saw that advertised all over Berlin as well. And yeah, that like harness is kind of the dynamic that you just described, where the woman can initiate and the man is usually like an implicit yes.
Well, and the original one,
Tinder
released a bunch of really interesting statistics recently. Uh-huh. They every now and then they do, don't they? And it was the Pareto distribution of all the top value males, the top, mm-hmm. I don't know, 20% getting 90% of the women.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Like the responses.
Yeah.
Which is another thing that people do say that monogamy mm-hmm. fixes. That natural distribution that... If you ask, I mean, I've seen social experiments like this so many times. You know, you go to a random group of people, show them like, is this an attractive person? You know, if it's a man, they pretty much say yes, all the way down to the, you know, to the bottom. or rate this girl. Uh-huh. It's always 7, 8, 7, 8, you know, whatever, or 10 if they're really attractive. But the other way around, when it's females rating males, it's much lower, unless there's someone who's obvious and then they get all the attention.
Uh-huh.
And monogamy solves one of these problems because it means the high value men cannot just take all the women, which is what happens if you let the free market decide. What do you think about that? Because, and it, once again, the theory beyond that goes that what's dangerous for society is disenfranchised men.
Mm-hmm.
And the main disenfranchisement is not having a female partner, not being able to have sex, not being able to have kids, whatever. I don't know.
Well, I don't really follow that argument because you said that monogamy fixes the like quality male having all the females, but it goes both ways because if you're not monogamous, then the female can also have multiple partners. So, in this hypothetical scenario, so also... she would partner with more males.
Yeah,
so
she always partners with all the high value males.
So
the low value males still don't get much.
How does that work though? Because then just like the top people would just like be partnering with each other and
yes, which is kind of I think true. Well, the high value people. So you know, with men, it's
yeah. But then so the high value people just partner with each other, and then with the lower value. It's awful to speak about people like that, but maybe like the less attractive. Would then less, or less appealing, I don't know, less competitive.
Saleable,
yeah, less competitive. They would still be like there in their tier.
Possibly, possibly, but not instinctively, as you see on Tinder. You know, people don't swipe right on lower value. Girls don't swipe right on lower value males. Maybe until they're forced to, I don't know. Until
but also there is this, like, there's this like false reality with these dating apps because in real life, of course, like there's a lot more to a human than what you see on their Tinder profile. So I do think that those statistics are also skewed to literally just like physical appearance and then like three words that you write there that probably nobody reads anyway.
And whether or not that you're holding a dog in your hand, apparently.
Correct. Or posing in front of a flashy car. Like, that does it for me. But no, I mean, in reality, like human interaction, like you have pheromones, right? You have the way you smell to each other, body language, all those things that will probably mix up all those statistics. And that's the stuff that really matters. I mean, not really just the swiping.
Okay, so how does it, if you don't mind me asking, how does an ethical non-monogamous relationship work? Here's my take, obviously. I probably couldn't handle that scenario.
Right, mainly that's what a lot of people say to
painful
me.
Painful for me, painful for my partner.
Yeah. That's
Do you have to overcome the pain, or is it just not there to begin with?
Yeah, the pain is such a good starting point, because really, where does any pain come from? It comes from fear, some past trauma, fear of abandonment, low self-esteem, or not even low, pathologically low, but just like maybe lower self-esteem, insecurities. That's where people get jealousy from, because jealousy is not, to me, really a natural, innate emotion. It's something that we also are brought up to have. And that's something that you can, if you're in the right relationship, you can heal that.
Okay, what about this then? The theory is that your heart can only be broken to the depth that you're willing to open it up to somebody else.
Okay.
Right. That would be my experience. The closer I get to someone, the deeper the wound when it's ripped away, you know. Does that not work? Does that not happen in ethical non-monogamy?
Well, sure. I mean, we're prone to hurt. I mean, it's part of the human experience. I don't see how that would be different in monogamous versus non-monogamous couples.
Mm-hmm. Well, presumably it doesn't happen in monogamous, because there's no splitting. There's no...
Oh, because you never...
You just never have to address that. And in fact, the point of monogamy is to create a long-lasting bond.
Yeah.
Which is a supportive bond. It's a lot of things, isn't
that's
it?
That's the same in non-monogamous couples. You are still creating a lot. At least the arrangement that I have is that I have a husband that's my primary partner, and we're creating a lasting bond, and we're totally committed to each other as partners. I mean, we've been now married for 10 years and together for 15. But we just don't limit... You know, we don't monopolize each other, to say it in libertarian terms. So I don't put a cap on like who he can be with, and how he can experience the other person. And if there's something that excites him, a person that he wants to get to know better, have a romantic relationship with, then I have no problem with that. I didn't always hold that position. My initial position was the same as yours. I could never do that. And that's just like absurd. It's just hurtful. But it's a journey that I've been on. And now we're in a place where we say to each other, hey, you're excited by golfing. You want to do figure skating? Please do that. Like, live your life. You want to date this girl? Please. Like, have fun.
I know, but hitting a golf ball and is a less intimate than that, you know, having sex with someone.
Is it? Oh, it is golfers for me. But it's the same, really. If your partner says, to have a fulfilled life, I really want to go on a date with this person, I want to get to know them better. It's not necessarily about sex. It can just be, you know, meeting somebody, exploring, like, maybe a romantic relationship, maybe intimacy. But who am I to say to him, you're not allowed to do that?
What about the problem, probably not a problem, of then falling in love with someone else?
Wanting
to spend more time with that person than...
So you said love and time. So love to me is an indivisible valuable. It's just, there's an infinite amount of love that we all have and can give. And you have three kids, so you know, you had a first kid, you love them. Second kid, you also love them. Third kid, you also love them. You know, if you had seven kids.
I've got my favorite though.
Sure you do. Don't tell. But and then actually it even multiplies, because you see their interaction, and then there's more love in the family. You never run out. So that is not a problem. Time is, limited, obviously. So that's something that you have to do. It's time management. Your life is time consuming. So for sure, figure that stuff out. But I would never worry about if you allow your partner or encourage them maybe to like explore love, feelings for somebody else. It will not take away any love that they have for you. On the contrary, I find.
Unless there is a problem within the relationship, maybe, I suppose.
Yeah, but if there's a problem within the relationship, then being monogamous is not going to fix that problem, right?
I don't know. I mean, that's not been my experience. My experience of a long-term relationship has been some terrible moments of you know, which always resulted in a better experience of life.
Yes, if and you overcome fact, them.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. But I think, honestly, that many of the... My partner holds a mirror up to me, like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the most crystal clear mirror because they're the most, you know, the closest to you. So you could go through life never encountering many of these issues within yourself unless you did the long-term thing. Yeah. And there's a, I mean, talking of monogamy, there's of course, there's forced monogamy, you know, enforced monogamy, I suppose you should say, culturally, mm-hmm. which is also, I think, there for a reason. Because, and it's for that reason, if you take arranged marriages, very, very, most people would say, oh, terrible idea for an arranged marriage. But I think what I learned from long-term relationships is you can make anything work with anyone.
Correct.
And what the monogamy does is it forces you to make that decision.
Yeah, but monogamy doesn't force you to do that. It's the just a commitment to like to each other, because you can be equally committed and have a non-monogamous relationship. But I'm still committed. I'm going to be here. And things get hard or company goes bankrupt, you know, kids get sick. I'm still here. So the non-monogamous part doesn't really come into play into that.
Okay, that's where I think would be too murky for me. I would feel like I wouldn't know where it would end up. Put it that way.
Yeah, you never know where it ends up. That's correct. I mean, freedom is dangerous.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I can see the point of it. I just think maybe it's a personality thing once again. You know?
Possibly, and I'm definitely not out to convert people to be non-monogamous. I just think that it's really important to, when you make these life decisions, for example, how you arrange your relationship, that's one of the most crucial decisions, or who you partner with as a romantic partner. It's one of the most crucial decisions of your life, and that will affect your happiness probably more than anything else. And therefore, I think it should be approached really consciously and mindfully, and you just don't copy-paste what previous generations did. You say, I'm going to be the architect of this, and I'm going to design it in a way that really works for me and for my partner. And if that means having a monogamistic arrangement, then that's fantastic. If it means something else, then that's fantastic. But it should be explored. And if you, and I'm not saying you, of course, I'm just saying people in general, if they default to monogamy out of fear of what could happen, then I don't think that's a well-informed decision, because it's a fear-driven decision. Wherever there's a fear, that's where you should dig in, right? Once the decision is made out of happiness and abundance and generosity and love, then that's the right decision. And whether that's monogamy or whether there's something completely different, then that's the right one for you.
I suppose I'm not deciding to be monogamous consciously. Mm. I just know what the results of non-monogamy would be for me. And if I find myself in a situation where I could be non-monogamous, there's no... I've always followed that timeline forward, and it never ends well. It's a lot of hurt and pain.
Yeah.
And yeah, I know, but like, I'm not saying that it... it's not the
that's
way.
Of course, like your mind telling you because there is some,
it's a
some fear.
I mean, yeah. I know what it feels like to be, you know, for example, my partner's not expecting me to be non-monogamous. So if I was, it would be a thing. It would be a very bold move.
Yeah. But if you never had that desire to be, or you never felt that monogamy was limiting you in any way, then of course, like, then you're living the right life.
You do. Well, no, I'm pretty sure everyone feels that monogamy is holding them back. Like,
really? Well okay. No, then
I know,
that's something
but
worth exploring. Then.
It is. Mm-hmm. And I can explore that very easily on my own, if you know what I'm saying. And then it goes away.
Yeah. And then that would not be the ethical part, right? That's just like non-monogamy that a lot of people live, where if you just do something behind your partner's back, then...
No, but what I mean is the urge to be non-monogamous, I find, often is a bit of a superficial urge in men. It's basically, you know, the urge to have sex.
Right.
Which isn't necessarily like the deepest feeling that we feel. I don't know, maybe you disagree, but...
I'm not sure about that one, but I do think that if it's a feeling, like, it's valid. And if there is something, and I'm not saying that's your case, I'm certain that it's not, but if there was somebody who felt really held back by that, and these urges are really strong, and it's making me, like, question my life, then the solution is not, like, to cheat on your partner. The solution is come to your partner and open up that conversation. You know, and if you have a perceptive partner, then you can find alternative, because we're talking about parallel structures, right? Building something different than the status quo. Then this is a perfectly viable option, and it can actually lead you to a place of, like, much more freedom and much more joy and much more open communication with your partner, and also honesty. You know, a lot of this stuff is not easy to bring up, and yes, there's pain, yes, there's hurt, but if you explore it in like a conducive way, and especially if you have a perceptive partner that is just willing to, like, hear you out, you can build, like, whole new vistas together, a whole new life. And it's just one of the things that just should be questioned a little bit, just like, how am I going to raise my kids? I want to think about that before I do that. I want to make the right decisions that are aligned with my values, and my values before anything is just individual freedom.
So is that the natural places you end up as a freedoms or free market sort of maximalist? Is that you end up in the free market of relationships as well?
That was the case for me. It's certainly not going to be the case for everybody, but I think that again, like, what I would urge people to do is just to explore these life choices. You don't have to dissect every single choice, like, down to the color of your shoelaces, but these things that are so major in your life: who am I with, how are we raising our kids, money, you know, where am I living, what kind of business am I running? You really have to do that consciously, especially if we're going to, like, build a better society, build parallel structures. We have to think about what the hell we're doing and why, and what values are we founding this on. So as a freedom-loving person, I always come from that. Therefore, I homeschool my kids, or, like, give them a lot of freedom. Therefore, I have a non-monogamous relationship, which is, again, not a necessity, but for me it was.
A place to explore freedom.
Correct. But again, the ethical part is important. So you always, like, it's between consenting adults, right?
Voluntary non-monogamy. You called it ethical.
Yeah.
Who called it that? Is that your...
That's a term that exists out there. And of course, because a lot of people are non-monogamous, but their partner is not aware of that, right? So that's where the ethical part kind of, like, gets left behind. So that's a big one.
A lot of people would say non-monogamy is not ethical anyway, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they would. I'm sure they would. But because it's like, what, it's in the Bible or something.
Probably.
But, yeah.
I don't know. I'd go for voluntary non-monogamy.
Yeah,
but dual voluntary. Yeah, yeah, but you could be you being voluntary. Yeah,
I could say consensual, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah, that's always the big one.
Okay, right. I definitely have to stop now, I'm afraid.
Okay.
I don't want to. I think next time I come out to Prague, I'd like to carry this conversation
on. Yeah, great.
I've got to get to the next
Absolutely,
interview.
Yes.
But before you go, I've got one last question. It's the question we ask everyone in this podcast. You have a sabbatical of a 1 year, during which time someone has paid for your life. You don't have to worry about money. Uh-huh. You do have all the things you have now, children, this, that, and the other, but you can do whatever you want with that sabbatical. What do you do for that year?
Probably, like, perpetual travel and to countries that are warm. I would, am I not allowed to work, or can I still work?
You can do whatever you want. Yeah. The point is, I'm trying to take the element of the incentive to have to earn money out of the equation. Uh-huh. I often find that when you do, I do this with myself all the time. If you take away the making money part, I realize what it is I really want to do.
What's that for you?
For me, this. I would literally, I do this more.
Oh.
I think conversations are the most, it's where it's at. You know, I've been a creative my whole life, visually. But in the last sort of five years, I suppose, I've realized the best way to communicate is not visually, actually, and even in films. It's actually long form conversations. Mm. And I think they just scaled for the first time in history. I think the ability to, you know, I was telling someone the other day, I've had life changing experiences mowing the lawn outside, listening to a podcast, listening to two people talk, and then just the penny dropping on a very important, you know, key thing in my life. Just listening to two people talk on the other side of the world, could be anywhere, you know. And we never had that option until the internet. We had the printing press, you know, which means you could read what someone said. But the spoken word has only just scaled recently. And I now no longer care about the visual at all. I feel like my whole... So I would be doing more of this, 100%. Mm-hmm. I just do this as much as I could. At the moment, I am constrained by money, you know. Mm. I travel as much as I can because I don't want to do these things over the internet. It's completely different. Sitting here at a desk with you in Prague, it's a completely different experience to... you know, doing it over the internet.
Absolutely.
But it costs, you know, the hotel's 100 a night, the flights are this, the flight, you know.
You can stay in my place if you want.
Oh, next thanks. Time. Yeah, cool.
Sure. Really, I mean it.
Yeah. I will. Well, okay. Funnily enough, we're coming back a lot.
Okay.
We're coming back in BTC Prague, which is happening. And of course,
is that?
That is June, I think.
June, all right.
And then obviously we're coming back for Liberty in Our Lifetime.
That's October again, or?
It's around the same time. Yeah. We're just pinning the dates down now.
Okay.
But so what were you going
to
do?
All right, so let me answer your question again. So if I were to have a year of like absolutely no commitments, I would definitely take the family and travel. Warm places. I love being in Asia. I love eating just like street food. You know, I've been in a hospital in Vietnam because I got sick from street food and it was so worth it. So,
worth it.
I just love like eating crazy stuff. So that was a great experience also being like IV drip because you have such horrible food poisoning.
Right.
It was fun. So I would do that. But let me tell you, I would be no more happy than I am now. And that's, I know that for sure because I would be with my family. I love being with them. Again, I'm doing my work. So I bring my happiness with me wherever I am. And so I don't even desire it that much.
Mm. No, but you're physically, you're pretty, you take wherever you lay your hat, it's your home kind of thing, you know, that expression?
Yeah.
Because your business, I wish I was a bit more like that. Unfortunately, I'm a more of the larger entity. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, it's very difficult for me to do that. It works for me to be positioned in one place. But when I was younger, that's all I did. And I have this debate a lot with people that mode, that the nomadic life works much better for your average Westerner, let's say, when they're younger.
Mm.
Because moving with your family is a whole different thing.
Yeah, you're more luggage, that's for sure.
Well, it's the emotional luggage, I think. Like,
that's correct.
There is a debate to be had about how productive it is for your kids to not have them see the same thing every day for 10 years.
Yeah.
I know that some kids do suffer when they don't wake up in the same house every day for a long period of time.
I do believe that. I think there's pros and cons to both, because also the variety of experiences you get and the exposure to just like differences, you can only achieve that through traveling, but something is lost for that. But also in the like static lifestyle, something is lost in that as well. So, you know, nothing is perfect, but I do agree with you. Just traveling is phenomenal. Yeah. So we all love it.
Yes. Well, I'm going traveling tomorrow. I'm going home.
You're going home tomorrow. Yeah. All right.
Thanks for speaking, Pavel. It's been really cool speaking to you. And
Thank you.
Certainly in another time when I come back, I'm going to continue this conversation because I feel like I've still got questions.
Excellent. I look forward to it. Thank you, Tim.